Welcome, everybody, to Clinical Rounds for this week. I'm Dr. David Brady, the Chief Medical Officer of Designs for Health and the Director of the Nutrition Institute at the University of Bridgeport. And a couple of people that will be on the call tonight. First is Andy Casagranda, who's the Director of Product Development for Designs for Health, and he'll be moderating the call tonight. So, Andy, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, David. Good to be back on.
Good. Do you have some introductory announcements on upcoming events before I introduce Dr. Hedberg?
Yeah, sure do. I'm getting towards the end of the year here into the fall, and September, October, and November, we have some seminars. We have our core, last of our core series here coming up, and first off, we have Core 2, which is September 22nd, so you still have time to sign up for this. This is Core 2, Functional Endocrinology, a 21st Century Approach to Thyroid and Adrenal Disorders and the Diabetes Epidemic. This will be Rebecca Murray and Dr. Alan Weiss, and this will be in Traverse City, Michigan. And if you can't make the Michigan date, we're doing this as well on November 3rd in Chicago, Illinois. And again, this is Core 2, Functional Endocrinology. Now, we also have Core 3 coming up. The first date is September 29th. This is Core 3, 21st Century Epidemics, Autoimmune, Lyme, and Stealth Infectious Disease. And this is with David Brady and Dr. Todd Lapine. And this is in San Francisco, California. And, again, we'll be doing this seminar as well in Houston, Texas, on October 27th. And, again, this is the Core 3, 21st Century Epidemics. David, I don't know if you want to give a little bit of preview to that.
Yeah, actually, the Core 3 seminar series which is our newest seminar on autoimmune disease and Lyme and stealth infections, and all that really dovetails perfectly with the content tonight that Dr. Hedberg and I will be discussing. So it's a good compliment if you are into some of the stuff you hear tonight and want to spend a really in-depth day going through some of the latest on the pathogenesis of autoimmune disease and early prediction and prevention, predictive autoantibody testing, concepts of molecular mimicry, the hygiene hypothesis, how to find those at risk, how to stop the train of autoimmune disease, how to deal with stealth-infectious components to a lot of chronic diseases, including, you know, that from Lyme and co-infections. Come see us in San Francisco on the 29th and in Houston on the 27th. Also, I wanted to let everyone know we have a couple of other events that I will be speaking at. One is at the University of Bridgeport here on October 6th, and it's in conjunction co-sponsored event on integrative medical approaches to chronic disease between the University of Bridgeport's Division of Health Sciences and Stony Brook University Medical School. And that will be on campus at UB, and that's on October 6th. You can just go to bridgeport.edu and to Health Science Postgraduate Education for information on that event. And then I'll be speaking at an A4M event that's really interesting in November, on November 3rd and 4th in Fort Lauderdale, called Gut, Brain, and Autoimmune Disorders. And I'll be on the speaking panel with some really stellar speakers and some people have made transformational changes in this work, including Alessio Fasano, director of the University of Maryland Center for Celiac Research, who's done a lot of publication and really brought the concept of hyperpermeability of the GI mucosa and leaky gut to the mainstream medical literature in immunology and gastroenterology. Jerry Mullen, who is a friend of mine and an alumnus of the University of Bridgeport's Nutrition Institute. Jerry is a medical doctor and director of integrative health services, gastroenterology services at Johns Hopkins Hospital. William Davis, the author of the New York Times bestseller Wheat Belly, will be on the panel. David Perlmutter, who many of you know, very gifted functional neurologist, spoken at IFM many times. Liz Lipsky, who's a great nutritionist and really known for her food as medicine approach to a lot of disorders, including autoimmune and GI disorders, and myself. So if you want to come down, it's at a beautiful property on November 3rd and 4th in Fort Lauderdale. If you want more information, just go to a4m.com and look up the information for the Florida seminar. That being said, let's get on with it. Let me introduce our speaker for tonight. Dr. Nicholas Hedberg is a good friend of mine. I've known Nick for, I think, somewhere around 10 years now. We both went to one of the same schools in our careers, not at the same time, but we, I guess, met at, I think, a internal disorders conference in New Orleans, I think was the first time, about 10 years ago. But I've followed Nick's work and his career, and he's done some outstanding work. Nick is a board-certified chiropractic internist by the American Board of Chiropractic Internists. He received his bachelor's training in exercise science from the University of Florida. He received his Doctor of Chiropractic from the Texas Chiropractic College in Houston. He currently practices in Asheville, North Carolina, and focuses on Lyme disease, thyroid disorders, and autoimmune disease. He's the author of the book, The Thyroid Alternative, which is a comprehensive guide to diagnosing and treating thyroid disorders. He lectures at a lot of different integrative medicine conferences, and he's published in a lot of journals. He teaches functional medicine concepts through many forms, including Functional Medicine Town, Professional Co-op, and with Hawthorne University. And his particular interest lately is the role of stealth infections in chronic disease, and in that effort to get this message out, he's created a program called the Infection Connection and does some online training in these concepts, and he'll tell you more about that as the night goes on. Little known to everyone in the professional world, but known to me, Nick is an accomplished opera singer, actually. So you'll hear that when you hear him talk. You can hear that come through in his voice. Anyway, Nick, thank you for being on. I know you've been on Clinical Rounds before, and thanks for coming back and being a guest again.
Thanks for having me on, David. It's good to be here.
Great. Well, I mean, this is a fascinating topic, and the topic that's really been sort of obsessing me for the last couple of years, as you can see by the content or the topic of our Core 3 seminar. I've recently written pretty extensive articles on these concepts in Townsend Letter, in Naturopathic Doctor News and Review, and in other forms. So I'm really interested and jazzed about tonight's call and interviewing you, because I hope to learn more about this as well, because it's literally emerging science day by day. I think it would be a full-time job just to keep adequate surveillance of the literature on just what we're going to talk about tonight and stay current with it. So anyway, I know that I kind of started having to really school myself on this stuff out of sheer necessity by virtue of my patient population and how it's changed over the years. And I guess we'll talk about that a little bit more. But I wanted to really learn a little bit more how you got started in managing patients with chronic infections or stealth infections, and how you found your way into really almost subspecializing in this area of functional and integrative medicine.
Right. So it was actually about 8 or 9 years ago, I was actually listening to you, David, talk about the connection between Yersinia enterocolitica and autoimmune thyroid disease. And ever since then, it's just really been an interest of mine. I knew it was something that I needed to learn a lot about. Started seeing more and more patients with Hashimoto's and chronic fatigue and various autoimmune diseases. And, you know, you start doing all the things that you know in functional medicine, healing the gut, vitamin D, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you can do all that, but there's that group of patients, that population, that they just don't respond to those things. And I found with a lot of those patients, when you dig a little bit deeper, a lot of times you'll find an underlying infection that's been overlooked. You know, I saw my first Lyme patient back then and didn't really know, you know, how to treat it, and sent the patient out for treatment you know, heavy doses of antibiotics through an integrated medical doctor. And the patient came back, you know, about 9 months later, and she was just worse off than she was going in. She couldn't handle the treatments, and started seeing some more Lyme patients after that, and realized that I had to learn to treat that as well, you know, from a functional medicine perspective. And the way I think about it is, a lot of times it's not that there are more infections out there. Obviously, there's more Lyme infections, but a lot of us have these infections in us, and it's the consequences of our modern-day lifestyles, high stress, poor diets, environmental toxins, things like that. And our immune system just can't keep up with it. And then the infections that we have either emerge because they're opportunistic infections, or we're not just able to fight them off. So that's how I got started in treating these types of disorders.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, it is food for thought. I often wonder, are these infections more prevalent? Are we just better at finding them? Are we more aware of them since people have started talking about them and connecting the dots with the associations between certain infections and certain chronic pathologies? Is it like you just said, you know, just another straw on the camel's back, you know, and the back is so laden with different stresses and pressures in modern patients that, you know, the infections that otherwise wouldn't really cause much of a problem in a stronger individual become, you know, clinically significant. And I don't know what the right answers are, but I can tell you one thing. I've been practicing now for 21 years, and I think, personally, I think patients are getting sicker in many more complicated ways. And I've stepped back and tried to analyze that, too. Is it just because, you know, compared to 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, I get probably more complicated patients because a lot of virtually my entire patient base is referrals from other practitioners, and a lot of it's from other integrative and functional practitioners. And I tend to get sent, I think, the worst of the worst or the complicated ones, the ones that just don't respond and don't get better. So maybe my patient cohort, you know, is skewed. But overall, I just think patients are more complicated in their illnesses, and the whole systems biology, you know, web, if you will, are swirling around their presentation is more complex. And I wonder, you know, I practice in Connecticut, too, so it's even more complicated because, you know, the whole Lyme and co-infection thing is so so prevalent here, and it's so hard to really treat this stuff, and it's hard to test adequately for it. It's hard to treat it adequately. It's hard to know you have it. How much is that in play that we're just not aware of? And you mentioned, you know, fixing the gut and vitamin D and all the normal functional medicine kind of approaches that used to work, you know, almost miraculously with the majority of chronically ill patients. I find that it works with a smaller and smaller percentage of my patients, and we got to go digging into other very complicated stuff. So do you see that same phenomena, and do you have any feelings on that?
Definitely see the same phenomenon. Doing all the functional medicine things that we should be doing, patients aren't getting better, and they're coming in with just all kinds of, they're almost things that you can't even label, you know, so-called mystery illnesses, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, all the different autoimmune diseases, and then in some cases, there's just nothing really showing up. I mean, even on a comprehensive blood chemistry, I mean, there's just nothing there, but they're so sick. And when you scratch a little bit deeper, you know, a lot of times you do find infections. And a lot of these infections will mimic, you know, those conditions that I was just talking about, where conventional medicine says, well, you know, we don't really know the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome or, you know, autoimmune disease. It's just a consequence of, you know, the relationship between genetics and our environment. But there's also not a lot of profits to be made in long-term antibiotic use, and that could be another reason why it's not as looked at as heavily as it should be, you know, speaking in regards to the connection between infections and some of these chronic illnesses.
It's also amazing in the history when you do an intake on a patient. In fact, it happened twice today. With three new patients today in my patient load, two of them had the onset of these kind of chronic things as they tell the story. The onset was immediately after they had a significant, like, kind of viral infection that came out of nowhere, like an upper respiratory type of infection that just didn't want to go away. And since then, they've never quite been right. So, you know, that, and, you know, that whole connection between a viral insult and then it kind of becoming a chronic smoldering thing has been, you know, something that's been known in chronic fatigue circles for a long time with, you know, CFIDs or, you know, chronic fatigue and immune deficiency syndrome, and people have looked at lymphocyte subsets and all that forever. But I think maybe that phenomenon is much more broad-based than just in that one. So how do you go about identifying infections, or in particularly stealth infections, clinically or in the laboratory?
Of course, you know, you start with a comprehensive history, like you just said. I'm finding that as well. You know, someone will have a really bad, cold or flu or GI infection, tick bite, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then they just never were able to recover. So that's a good indicator in the patient's history. And, of course, where they live, history of tick bites. And some of these patients will come in and they'll have just a fever of unknown origin. And, you know, there's really no signs of cancer. So, you know, just the basics of a fever is that's an infection until proven otherwise. And a lot of them will say, you know, I just always run a temperature. Or they're the opposite. They're just extremely cold all the time. And then, of course, if they have any of these conditions, you know, that we've mentioned, that is, of course, another major red flag. And then on your blood chemistries, obviously looking at the CBC, you know, you're probably finding very, very low white blood cell counts in a lot of these patients across the board, and then just changes in their differentials, a lot of monocytosis. You know, you'll see neutrophils coming down, lymphocytes going up, and it's just kind of always there. And then a lot of markers of inflammation, sedimentation rate, highly sensitive C-reactive protein, fibrinogen. So a lot of times, if there aren't really a lot of signs of what's causing their inflammation, you know, if they're eating well, low stress, because you're probably seeing some of these patients as well who come in and they're doing everything right. I mean, on paper, everything looks good, but they just can't, I mean, they just can't break through and start feeling better.
Yeah, I mean, I got to tell you, the majority of my patients these days come in, they're on really good diets. They're doing all the right things lifestyle-wise. They come in with rattling bags of supplements. You know, they've been to a million providers. It's none of the easy, low-hanging fruit stuff that we learned on fixing them. You know what I mean? There's a piece of the puzzle that a lot of people are missing. I think the stealth infections are a big thing, but even in some of them, I do some of the tests you were just talking about, and even they're clean. You know, even the CBC, the DIS is fine. I mean, there's none of those even things I learned on chronic infection presentation. And but, you know, clearly there's something just dragging them way, way, way down. They're very reactive to a lot of things immunologically. Do you get into specific viral titers? Do you do lymphocyte subsets? Do you look at any of those things routinely?
I do routinely do the viral titers, looking for, you know, reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus,
right.
Herpes simplex virus, things like that. So, yeah, I do test for those.
Is there a specific panel that you use in doing that with commercial lab, or do you just pick certain, you know, you do EBV and CMV and, you know, HSV or Hep C. Is there any kind of pattern to what you do?
I just do I do a combination of PCR testing and also IgD, IgM, and, you know, it's just a matter of interpreting it the right way. Just because it's IgD positive, of course, that doesn't really tell you that it's active. So that's how I interpret those.
And how about, well, let's talk about mycoplasma. Because, you know, that's been talked about a lot in autoimmune disease and people sort of with these chronic long-term issues. What's your thought on mycoplasma playing any kind of role?
Mycoplasma, I think, is playing a huge role, especially in rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, chronic fatigue, and fibromyalgia especially. Mycoplasma is interesting because when they first discovered it, they actually thought it was a virus because it was so stealth. And mycoplasma is the smallest known bacteria in the microbiology world. So it's very, very stealth. All of these bacteria that we're talking about are gram-negative. And just to take everyone back, you know, it's a micro. You have gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria. And the gram-positive bacteria, they only have one cell wall. It's very thick. And the gram-negative bacteria, they have two cell walls, and they have a periplasmic space in between the cell walls. And so antibiotics may penetrate the first cell wall, but they can actually get stuck in the periplasmic space while the bacteria learns how to deal with it. And then if it does break through the second cell wall, these microbes have what are called efflux pumps that will just pump it right back out. So phenomenal defense stealth mechanisms by some of these pathogens, especially mycoplasma. And there's two studies here I just wanted to quote briefly. The first one is called Multiple Mycoplasmal Infections in the Blood of Patients with Chronic Fatigue and Fibromyalgia. And basically they looked at about 91 patients for four different strains of mycoplasma, fermentans, pneumonia, hominis, and penetrans. And they found that 54 out of 91 patients with chronic fatigue and or fibromyalgia had mycoplasma pneumonia. 44 out of 91 had mycoplasma fermentans. 28 out of 91 had hominis. And 18 out of 91 had penetrans. And the interesting thing is that those that had multiple mycoplasma infections had a much longer history of illness. So what I found is that once mycoplasma takes hold in the system, it's very, very hard to break through. And I think some of these people with chronic fatigue and these other disorders have these underlying mycoplasma infections. The other study is looking at the distribution of mycoplasma in patients with arthritis. And basically they just aspirated the synovial fluid of patients with rheumatoid arthritis, non-rheumatoid arthritis, and osteoarthritis. And 79% of the patients with rheumatoid arthritis had mycoplasma in the synovial fluid. 100% of the patients with non-rheumatoid arthritis had mycoplasma, and 80% of patients with just your general osteoarthritis had mycoplasma in the joint. So, and it makes sense. You know, there's something that's causing the inflammation in these joints, and this is an area that I think is really overlooked, not only in these arthritic patients, but in chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia patients as well.
Yeah, well, that gets into a whole other can of worms. I mean, is it really in fibromyalgia patients, or is it people in the studies that were mislabeled as fibromyalgia patients? You know, are they really fibromyalgia patients? Do they really have central allodynia and disruption in descending anthinociception, or are they just incorrectly diagnosed and labeled saying they have fibromyalgia, and then they found out they have mycoplasma? You know what I mean? It's really dirty literature, so it's hard to make really strong takeaways on these different labels and how they associate to different things, because, you know, the the inclusion criteria for fibromyalgia is all over the map, I mean, literally, and the diagnostic criteria is terrible. So that brings up some interesting other confounding factors. But back to mycoplasma for a minute, how are you determining if that might be in play in your patients?
Right. Just blood testing, and again, doing serum, PCR, and IgG, IgM. For these.
Are you doing that for a regular commercial laboratory like Quest or LabCorp or something like that, or a specialty lab?
Doing that through medical diagnostic laboratories. They're a fairly large lab, and they have a really excellent infectious disease arm, and they'll test for many different strains of mycoplasma.
And then when you find it, how are you trying to treat it and eradicate it? You already said these are really resistant organisms even to, you know, prescription, pretty powerful antibiotics. So what is your approach?
Right. So there's a few really good herbal antibiotics that work well for mycoplasma. Interestingly enough, you know, outside of the herbal world, silver, the silvercillin product that Designs for Health has works very well for these intracellular gram-negative bacteria. And some of the big gun herbs are cryptolopus is really good for systemic bacterial infections, Sita, and Alcornia. Also Noni and Neem can work very well for mycoplasma as well. And then, of course, you know, doing all your other functional medicine basics, supporting the immune system. But those have worked quite well for these patients.
What about chlamydia? I know, you know, Charles Stratton at Vanderbilt has done a lot of work on chlamydia, or chlamydophilia, I guess is the more proper way to say it now. And its role as a stealth pathogen, most of his work is centered around multiple sclerosis as an etiological agent in multiple sclerosis, but also he has found it in other autoimmune type of disorders. What's your thought on chlamydophilia?
Yeah, and there's many, many papers out there on chlamydia talking about its connection with autoimmune diseases and a lot of neurological disorders as well. So chlamydia, you know, it is an intracellular bacteria, gram-negative. And, you know, most people are going to be more familiar with chlamydia pneumonia causing infection in the lung. But there is, you know, strong connections there with cardiovascular disease, central nervous system disorders, and a lot of neurological issues like Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis. And it's interesting because what we know about chlamydia is that monocytes can actually traffic chlamydia pneumonia across the blood-brain barrier. And once the monocyte carries the chlamydia across the blood-brain barrier, it will shed the organism in the central nervous system and induce neuroinflammation. And that can end up being a chronic issue. Late onset Alzheimer's disease, dementia, that's also been connected with chlamydia. And I guess the theory is it obviously is active in the central nervous system, but you have this chronic, low-grade, persistent brain infection that's obviously causing a lot of oxidative stress and inflammation in that area, leading to, you know, various mental and even some neurobehavioral disorders. So it's definitely something to look at. And I think these neurological disorders and, of course, cardiovascular.
How do you broach it with patients? Because the minute they hear chlamydia, you know, they're thinking chlamydia is trachomatis, and what do you mean? I have a sexually transmitted disease and yada, 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 even though, you know, it's estimated that 1 in 4 men with chlamydia have no symptoms, for instance, so how would they even know, right? Do you have to deal with that at all, with them just not understanding that?
Sometimes they do have a surprised look on their face. Trachomatis is, you know, the sexually transmitted chlamydia. the other two big ones that you'll see are chlamydia pneumonia and then chlamydia satachi. And those are the ones that, you know, are non-sexually transmitted. So I just explained that to them.
How do you are you testing for chlamydia?
Yes, yeah. Same as mycoplasma, doing PCR and IgG, IgM.
Now, with this lab that you're using, are you just are these ordered a la carte, or are they part of one larger panel that you use?
They're just ordered a la carte, yeah.
Okay. And when you interpret them, you said you're doing, what, IgM, IgG, and PCR, did you say?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So if you get an IgG positive but an IgM negative, you consider that just being a prior exposure and an IgM being more of an active infection?
Yeah, you know, if the IgM is positive, then it, of course it's a pretty good indicator that it's active. But the more I read about IgM, the more I find that it may only, you know, be positive for 7 weeks.
Right.
It might you know, come on 2 weeks after infection, and then it's only going to be positive for about 7 weeks, and then it's gone. So it's just the best.
So basically, in these chronic stealth infections, unlike an acute infection, the IgM may not really be worth that much.
Exactly. Yeah.
Then, if you have an IgG, how do you know it wasn't just an old prior exposure and not something that's really causing them an ongoing issue? It gets a little bit hard to tell, doesn't it?
It does. You just have to, you know, you just do the best you can with history, and if you just, you know, you've exhausted everything else, then you just have to try and treat it. And quite a number of times, you know, they start to improve.
And have you noticed any kind of specific correlations with the PCR testing and any of these antibodies? Do you find the PCR popping when the antibodies don't, or vice versa?
Mainly, I see it's just going to be one or the other in most cases. So there are a few times where the IgG, IgM will be positive and the PCR, but usually you'll see one or the other. A lot of times you'll see the PCR positive and the IgG positive,
right.
IgM negative, yeah.
And how about H. pylori? There's a lot of controversy over H. pylori because, you know, when we first really became the big buzz issue with, you know, gastritis, duodenitis, and ulcers, and then as a potential trigger of gastric cancer, the whole, you know, the reflex was, oh, H. pylori is bad, you got to get rid of it. Well, then, now you see all these studies showing that, you know, H. pylori is protective in many ways against being overreactive or having autoimmune disease in some ways, because we know that people with low levels of H. pylori, or since, you know, there's been relative H. pylori eradication compared to in years past, there's much higher levels of atopy. And we know that H. pylori is protective against atopic disorders. So what do you think about it, the whole H. pylori issue? Because personally, I'm absolutely confused by the whole thing.
I can give you, you know, my clinical experience with it. I think this is a really valuable clinical pearl that I'm going to give. And this is based on some research that I've, well, there's actually quite a few papers on it, but there's actually a journal called Helicobacter. I mean, that's just the name of it. And there's been a lot of papers in there studying the connection between H. pylori and Graves' disease. And they do find, when they do stool samples of patients with Graves, the vast majority of them come back with active H. pylori infection. So after I learned that, I started testing, you know, the Graves patients, and the vast majority of them do have active H. pylori infection. And when I treat the H. pylori, they get better.
And how are you treating the H. pylori? With a stool antigen, with a breath test, with serum antibodies? How?
Right. All the studies that I read regarding Graves and H. pylori, they're doing stool. but I like to do stool and also do it in blood.
Stool antigens. Stool antigens or detecting the DNA of H. pylori in stool?
I'm doing the Metametrics stool analysis.
All right, so that's
H. pylori.
Yeah,
okay. DNA. Right. And I like to do serum IgA, and many times the IgA is going to come back positive. So treating it is fairly straightforward. The GastroMend HP that Designs for Health has actually yielded excellent results in, I don't want to say eradicating, you know, because it's always there, but really suppressing the infection so it comes back negative. And these patients do improve. I just had a Graves patient last week, and she's in remission. And we were basically just doing a few things and focusing on the H. pylori. And, you know, her endocrinologist was all for it, you know, because the patient got better. So that's just something that I've seen, and I do treat the H. pylori when I see it. And these patients, Graves patients, definitely respond.
Have you seen the work of Alan Embringer on proteus, stealth proteus infection and rheumatoid arthritis? It is unbelievably compelling, and it goes back years. And his work has now been replicated by teams all over the world to show that it's not just a UK or even a Western phenomenon. There's been multiple research teams in England, Scotland, Ireland, France, Japan, other parts of Asia, Scandinavia, U.S., just all over the map, showing that rheumatoid arthritis, it's almost universal that these people have stealth proteus infections in the urinary tract. And, you know, most of us were trained urinary tract infections. You know, they're a no-brainer. People come in with, you know, pain on urination, flank pain, urgency. You know, you do a urinalysis, urine culture, whatever. They have leukocyte esterase and white blood cells and bacteria in the urine and all that, and you treat it and everything's good. However, you know, he's really showed that that's not the case, that organisms like proteus can exist in the urinary tract for years and years and years without overt clinical symptoms. But the proteus organism, mainly it's Proteus mirabilis, produces a bacterial hemolysin and a bacterial urease. And the hemolysin and urease have sequences that are very, very similar to host sequences, including to HLA-DR1, HLA-DR4, and he's really made the connections. He has the whole amino acid motif mapped between the HLA-DR molecules and the bacterial hemolysin from proteus, and basically he shows also there's a motif molecular mimicry between, I think, the proteus hemolysins and type 11 collagen. And type 11 collagen is unique to the small joints of the hand and the small joints that RA affects. It's always been a mystery why rheumatoid arthritis only affects certain joints of the body and spares others. And Embringer's work explains why that happens in his proteus stealth infection model, that there's a specific there's specific antibodies made to combat the proteus infection that cross-react only to type 11 collagen, which is only in these specific joint structures. And he goes on to explain a lot of the other mysteries of RA through this model, too. The female predominance in RA is about 3-1. Well, in UTIs, there's a strong female predominance because of, you know, anatomical differences. Disease onset between 30 and 50. Well, UTIs become much more prevalent in middle and older age women. Exacerbation after pregnancy, which is common. to have UTIs exacerbated after pregnancy. Low concordance rates in identical twins and fluctuating course of the disease tends to suggest really not a strong environment or not a strong genetic, but a strong environmental factor. And the high proportion of RA patients having positive rheumatoid factors can be attributed to a secondary phenomena due to B cell stimulation and the presence of antigen antibody complexes to proteus. So, I mean, it's elegant work. It's unbelievable. And yet, and this guy's a, you know, major, I think he's Sir Alan Emberger. I mean, he's a MD, PhD, major researcher. He's a consultant to CDC and NIH on infectious disease. And yet, there's no appreciation in standard medicine and the practice of rheumatology for molecular mimicry very much at all, but they're certainly not looking for stealth proteus infection. And Emberger couldn't even find commercial lab tests that were good enough to reliably detect it, so he had to basically come up with a laboratory methodology in his own labs, which he then shared with these other research groups. But if you read his papers, his treatment modalities are not just NSAIDs and biologicals and things. He uses those when necessary, but you know, he's kind of using almost naturopathic therapies. He's using alkalizing therapies like vitamin C. He's using high fluid intake. He's using diets that are high in certain herbals and certain like cranberry juice and others that have high blocking capability of these organisms to the mucosal lining because of the D-mannose and other kind of sugars that are in them. And he uses antibiotics. He uses Cipro to knock the heck out of the proteus infection, and he's gotten really good clinical outcomes, and yet there's nothing done like this in conventional medicine. They're just, at least I haven't seen it, they're just put on NSAIDs and they're, you know, DMARDs and, you know, biologicals and methotrexate and, you know, and those drugs have really nasty, serious complications. So are you aware of that research? Have you seen any of it? Do you have any
thoughts? Yes. It's just fascinating that you just brought that up because I'm sitting here staring at Ebringer and Rashid's paper, Clinical and Developmental Immunology, March 2006, entitled Rheumatoid Arthritis is an Autoimmune Disease Triggered by Proteus Urinary Tract Infection.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly what you just said. He says right here, patients will benefit by involved using vegetarian diets, high intake of water, cranberry juice as treatment. So yeah, I've read this paper and a few other ones, and it is really fascinating.
How about viruses? Let's get viruses. I want to talk about Lyme a little bit and have you know, time for enough questions. But you know, we've been talking a lot about bacterial organisms, but what about chronic viruses a little bit more? Do you have anything more to say about those connections to autoimmune disease? Because most of the connections that you see out there in the molecular mimicry type of thing are mostly to bacterial pathogens.
Right. Yeah, the whole, you know, study of viruses and autoimmune disease is fascinating. Almost, you know, pretty much any autoimmune disease you can find research with some kind of connection with one virus or another, and there's a really good paper published in the journal Virology in 2009, and basically it's a review of all the research out there on the connection between viruses and autoimmune thyroid disease, and particularly with Hashimoto's, they did find direct evidence of Epstein-Barr virus, herpes simplex virus, and parvovirus B19. And, I mean, the most interesting part of the paper is that the authors say that the virus can be inside the thyroid gland, but there's no systemic consequences. So they're saying that, you know, nothing may show up on the CBC. The patient might not have any symptoms at all, but the virus can still be active in the gland, causing an inflammation and thyroiditis. So this is just a fascinating paper that blew me away. And they talk about Graves' disease and acute thyroiditis. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, some people will develop thyroiditis just after they have a really bad flu virus. So, again, you know, pretty much any of the autoimmune diseases. And then another fascinating area is adenoviruses and celiac disease. I've been reading that it's possible that celiac disease can be, you know, triggered or, you know, significantly exacerbated by adenovirus activity. So just that whole area is really fascinating.
Well, what was that paper you mentioned in virology? Do you have?
Yeah, I have a copy of it. I can send it to you.
What was the year or anything? Was it recent?
It's virology, 2009, and yeah, Virology Journal, 2009.
All right, send it over to me, and we'll post it on the resources for tonight's call.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I know, and there's been a lot of work with viral triggers for type 1 diabetes, for instance. You know, everyone's familiar with the bovine beta-lactalbumin protein crossovers and all of that, but there's a lot of stuff on viruses as well. And, of course, we know there's a lot of there's a lot of work on viral triggers for cancers, and just, you know, well beyond just, you know, cervical cancer and others. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of literature on viral triggers for a lot of the most common cancers. So cancer really in many circles is starting to be looked at as an infectious disease. And IFN did a great conference a couple of years ago on stealth infections and particularly the infectious aspect of cancer, which I found fascinating. And, of course, there they did tackle Lyme. They had Borscano and they had some other people talking about Lyme. So talk to us a little bit about your experience with Lyme and some of the other co-infections and what can you share with us about those?
Right. So Lyme, the first connection that you see with Lyme is in Hashimoto's thyroiditis. There's been a couple good papers published in the journal Thyroid where they talk about homologies between Borrelia burgdorferi surface antigens and thyroiditis. But basically, those are people who are going to have a genetic susceptibility to thyroiditis. And, you know, like you've talked about a lot about before with Yersinia as well. But Lyme, you know, it's obviously the fastest growing infectious disease in the U.S. It's grossly underreported to the CDC, so the numbers are not what they really are per year.
I had a doctor tell a patient the other day that Lyme doesn't exist in New Jersey.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that was only in North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, it's just in Connecticut and New York, and it's not in New Jersey. The deer ticks in New Jersey don't carry it. Wow, that's interesting.
Right.
So.
Yeah, the infectious disease doctors here in Asheville don't believe that Lyme exists in North Carolina. So these people walking around with tick bites and erythema migraines, you know, bullseye rashes and all the Lyme symptoms and you get a positive Western blot and they say, oh, that's just a false positive. So people are not getting diagnosed properly. Treatment in the acute stages is, of course, doxycycline and other antibiotics, which should definitely be implemented. But then in some cases, and I see a tremendous amount of these, when Lyme is very, very chronic, I see a lot of people who they've tried the antibiotic route and it just hasn't really worked for them in chronic Lyme, or they're just not able to tolerate them. And so I have some really good herbal approaches to chronic Lyme.
Are these the same for Babesia, Bartonella, Ehrlichia, Rickettsia, all of that stuff, or do they?
Yes. Yeah.
They work for all of them. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Well, I'm really interested in this. Talk to us about that herbal approach. I mean, what are some of the botanicals you use? How do you apply them? You know, how aggressive are you with them? Do you get die-off reactions? How long do you have to use them? I mean, I'm sure everyone is wanting to know
right. That. So let's start with Borrelia burgdorferi. really the big guns for that, so to speak, herbally are, you know, sarsaparilla, also known as smilax, stephania root, Japanese knotweed, noni, neem, teasel, cat's claw, and wormwood. All work very, very well for Borrelia. The way that I look at it as you want to figure out which infection is the most active. Sometimes the co-infections are the most active. So sometimes it works better just going after one of the co-infections. Right. Yeah, you go after the co-infections first in some cases. And Babesia, you know, it's just like malaria. So wormwood, you know, also known as artemisinin, works very, very well for Babesia. Red root is going to be important because that really supports the lymphatic system, so it helps the body clear these infections. People with Babesia, they might have a lot of fever and chills, so bone set works very, very well for helping people deal with those fever and chills. Some of the other big herbs for Babesia are Cryptolepis, Seda, Alcornia.
Can you say that? Can you spell that herb?
The Cryptolepis, yeah, it's Cryptolepis. Mainly comes from Africa. Works very, very well for systemic infections like Babesia. Bartonella is going to be the second most common co-infection. And Bartonella, a lot of the symptoms are going to be mainly pain-based. So a lot of pain, sharp shooting pains, pains on the bottom of the feet, and things like that. Bartonella, some of the herbs that are good for that. The red root and the bone set, again, you want to use those to support the lymphatic system and to deal with some of the symptoms. And then I like using noni, neem, usnea lichen, and silver can work well for Bartonella as well. And then Japanese knotweed. Those can all work well for Bartonella. Those are going to be the two, you know, main co-infections. The other ones, like Ehrlichia and Rickettsia, I do see a lot of Rickettsia here in North Carolina. But Ehrlichia and Rickettsia, those herbs that I mentioned for Borrelia and the other co-infections, will work well for those as well.
And how about what's your experience with the silver for Borrelia?
Right. In order for it to really work, they have to do 2 teaspoons 3 times a day for 2 to 3 months. So they really need a lot of it. But
and what about these other herbs? Are you using combinations of these herbs in tincture form? Are you using individual herbs? And then how are you dosing them? Can you give us a feel for that?
Yeah, so most of them are tinctures. Some of them are capsules, starting out slowly and building their way up, and that's going to be just based on body weight, how much they take. If I'm going after, like, one co-infection, I'll go after it, you know, for 4 to 8 weeks and then shift, you know, into another infection after that. Sometimes
and with
are
you using drop dosages, certain amount of ounces? I mean, what's typical? I know with some of these, you know, really highly concentrated extracts out there, you know, the Byron White formulas and things, people are using, you know, sometimes 5-6 drops, and people are herxing, they claim. So, I mean, what's your experience?
Yeah, with those formulas, you know, you just start out at 1 or 2 drops a day, and then you want to max at 20 drops twice a day. But for all the other
tinctures, that small amount of drops of a botanical can have profound effects like that on one of these stealth pathogens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. But
do you think it's hard to believe that little of the substance would have a, you know, biochemical, like conventional mechanism to be able to disrupt those pathogens systemically. Do you think it's that, or do you think it's more, you know, like the German biological biophysics kind of medicine think that it's, you know, I don't want to say it's like homeopathy, but it's almost just like getting the substance in the body that has the right frequency or resonance or vibrance or whatever you want to call it. I mean, do you have any feeling on that?
I just think that, you know, with herbal medicine, as you know, it's the taste, you know, it's the smell, it's the formulation, you know, is really important, how herbs work together. I think if they're well formulated, then you don't need as much. But for just your general tinctures, you know, where you're at like a 5-to-1 ratio, we'll do, you know, 30, 60, or 90 drops and load, you know, every couple hours, you know, for a few days, and then drop back to 5 times a day. And then
some of these limes are 1-to-1s, you know, they're like really, mm-hmm. really strong tinctures.
Exactly. Right. And maintenance, you know, while you're cruising, so to speak, is taking them 3 times a day, you know, for your general tinctures. But in addition to, you know, just going after the microbe, if you look back at some of the herbal literature out there when they were treating syphilis, you know, they didn't exactly focus so much on the Treponema pallidum spirochete. They actually focused on lymphatic system and blood cleansers and, you know, diaphoretics and just really supporting the body to clear these things. Because that's the question that you had earlier, you know, it's like, why do some people get these infections? Why do they take hold, whereas other people can get the infections and they fight them off?
Well, once again,
a lot of times,
I practice with some really skilled people who do the, you know, more of the German biological approach, and they're using, you know, F-scans and they're using coils and Rife machines, and they're using EAV, and they're using all these different sort of energetic things. And I see with these stealth chronic infections, they get significant results when, you know, you don't get it with this sort of Western biochemical, you know, kind of model. And, you know, they're even isolating the frequencies of these pathogens and then, you know, introducing neutralizing frequencies and really going at it on an entirely different kind of level, which I find really interesting. But the reason I just brought that up is a lot of what they center their therapy on first is even not going after the pathogen, but, you know, really going after sort of those, using those lymphatic drainage type of remedy, which I think that kind of goes back to what you were saying about that approach. You know, that's even been used in historically, at least in some conventional circles also. What about Herxheimer reactions and die-off? I mean, it's so common, and when you start trying to treat these stealth infections, particularly Lyme, how do you manage that? Just slow it up? Or?
Right, the Herxheimer is the biotoxins. The biotoxins are released from the outer cell wall of the gram-negative bacteria, you know, as they die off. And you want to use herbs that have saponins, because saponins absorb those things. And, you know, Sarsaparilla, also known as Smilax, is excellent for absorbing those toxins and reducing Herxheimer. Japanese knotweed works as well for all the listeners out there. Japanese knotweed has a massive amount of resveratrol in it, so it does have a strong antioxidant effect and also a way of absorbing and reducing these toxins. And then ginger, you know, just taking ginger as a powdered capsule really isn't going to do much. You have to make them into a ginger juice or a really strong tea. So those three right there can significantly reduce the Herxheimer reaction.
How about biofilms? I mean, because that's a real kind of controversial thing. Everybody talks about eradicating biofilms, and there's all these products to eradicate biofilms with, you know, chelating agents and all these different things. And, You know, I've had a hard time honestly wrapping my mind around it because everyone pretends that only bad organisms live in biofilms, right? Only the things we don't want, pathogens and opportunistic organisms. Well, the reality is that the good organisms live in the biofilm too, including in the gut biofilm. So if you came up with an agent that knocked out the biofilm, how are you just knocking out the biofilm that houses the bad things and not knocking out the biofilm that houses the good things? That's, you know, I've yet to see any literature on knocking out only biofilms of bad organisms. So that's where I'm struggling with the whole biofilm therapy stuff.
I hear you. You know, it's early on I did try and address that, but I found that if I didn't really focus on that, I was still getting good results. You know, they're using, EDTA and then various enzymes like lumbrokinase, serrapeptase, nattokinase, bromelain, you know, all these things to dissolve the biofilms. But those enzymes that I mentioned, I'm really using those anyway for coagulation because especially in Lyme, you know, as a stealth mechanism, the microbes upregulate coagulation in the blood. So it's just harder for you to get to them. So, you know, I hear you. It's not something that I, you know, directly focus on. I think that the herbs that I'm using, I know that those have effects on biofilm, and the enzymes that support coagulation are going to have an effect. But, again, it's not a major focus for me, at least.
Hi, thanks. Excellent call. I had a question regarding flu vaccine, how this is affecting the whole thing just in general, and it's also in a case of a patient who had the flu vaccine and it then started the herpes virus just going crazy for him where, you know, he had problems with that. So as a virus, if there are any of these herbs that you deal with for the herpes as well?
I'm not knowledgeable about vaccinations or what they do, you know, in this particular topic.
Okay.
It's not something that I've studied or I don't really have a great interest either in vaccinations. But I think that there's a lot of practitioners out there who talk about vaccines, but they haven't really done an exhaustive review of the literature to really talk about it. And I'm definitely one of those people who doesn't know enough to confidently talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think conceptually, though, you know, an immune insult from vaccinations could be somewhat like, you know, having an infection, right? I mean,
right.
What it's meant to do. So, like, a lot of these disorders seem to come up after a viral infection or after some kind of infectious event. It seems logical that people may have problems and an immunological imbalance after they've been administered various, you know, vaccines, which are designed to modulate the immune system. But how exactly, you know, that works and what, how to connect those dots, I'm not sure anyone knows now.
Yeah. And what can you do about it? You know, if it does, so.
Right, okay. And then regarding the herpes, how do you treat that in terms of as a virus?
Right, herpes, the two things that I use that have worked really well, the first is monolaurin, works really, very well for herpes, and then a combination of olive leaf extract and Laria, Tridentata, also known as Chaparral. That combination of those three it rarely fails me with herpes.
Okay.
You said monolaurin, Chaparral, and what was the other one you mentioned, Nick?
Olive leaf extract.
Right, olive leaf, right. Okay, great. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Dr. Edberg. I think that the answer to this question might be the same as the previous question, and that is what have you found to be effective for treating Epstein-Barr virus, and how soon have you seen it be effective?
Okay, Epstein-Barr virus, what's worked well for me, again, is the monolaurin, and then Shisandra berry works very, very well for Epstein-Barr and Reishi extract.
Okay. And how soon have you seen this be effective in the treatment process?
It's usually pretty rapid, especially if you add Reishi to the mix. But the monolaurin, you build them up, you know, over a week, over a couple weeks until they're at a very high level for a few weeks and then drop back down. And then the Shisandra and the Reishi, they can just go full bore with it, and those work quite well.
The monolaurin is for encapsulated viruses, right, because it kind of dissolves the outer lipid layer that they're shielding themselves with?
Right.
Right, right.
So the monolaurin, you're saying you give them that at high dose to kind of expose them, and then these botanicals can do what they need to do once it's exposed? Am I understanding?
Right, they do their antiviral thing, and then, you know, something like Reishi is going to really
upregulate NK cells.
Other cells. Yeah.
Right. And what would be a high dose of monolaurin?
Right. I mean, the 600 milligram capsules, mm-hmm. Three of those, three times a day, is really the maximum.
Fascinating conversation, gentlemen. Could you repeat what you just said about the monolaurin? Was it 600 milligrams three times a day was the maximum dose?
It's three 600 milligram capsules three times a day.
Okay, got it. I wasn't.
Nine capsules, yeah.
Okay, I wasn't quite sure. Earlier in the conversation, you talked about the herbs you use for mycoplasma.
Right. The first two are noni and neem, N-E-E-M. And then the systemic herbal antibiotics that work well are the cryptolopus,
which
C-R-Y-P. It's an herbal tincture. Sida, S-I-D-A, and Alcornia.
Okay. And you'd mentioned silver.
Systemic.
You'd mentioned silvicillin. Was that a similar dose? Was it the similar doses that you'd mentioned elsewhere? 2 teaspoons three times a day?
Right. 2 teaspoons three times a day.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a particular rheumatoid arthritic patient with the elevated, the estrogen dominance and the IgG food sensitivities and the H. pylori. I was able to maintain or put the person back into a normal hormonal balance, lowering the estrogens and so forth, and eliminating the IgG food sensitivities and also eradicating the H. pylori. Would you at this point suggest that we go after mycoplasma? And what is that connection between the elevated estrogens and these RA people?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say with each case. First, you would obviously want to try and identify if there is active mycoplasma infection. You know, they might not. You said they have rheumatoid arthritis. They might not have mycoplasma. You know, it could be the proteus that we were talking about earlier or other infections. But if you are able to identify, you know, an infection, then I would definitely address that.
Dr. Hedberg, do you still use the CD57 as a screening tool for Lyme? Do you find it effective? Because I've read where some doctors are saying they find it totally useless in their practice, and others saying it's a really great tool. What's your opinion on the CD57?
Yeah, I run the CD57 on everyone if I suspect Lyme disease or one of the co-infections. I think it's a very, very valuable tool. If you do find the CD57 low, let me tell you what will boost that. Cat's claw also known as Cemento, will raise the CD57 count, and Reishi will also raise the CD57 count. So for those who don't know, it's theorized that Borrelia burgdorferi specifically suppresses the CD57 count, and therefore it's a good indicator of how much the Borrelia has hold in the system and how much it's suppressing the immune system. So I think it's a good test. I've used it for years, and but as with any test, it's not going to definitively tell you if they have Lyme or not.
Sure.
At
what range, low range, would you start to suspect the possibility of Lyme? What are your ranges for CD57?
The cutoff on the lab is 60,
mm-hmm.
but I like to be above 100.
Okay.
Some say it should be above 150, but that's all, just kind of anecdotal observation.
All right. Thank you very much. By the way, I just wanted to tell you, I've got Japanese research showing that vaccinations can trigger autoimmunity in mice. And the article is self-organized criticality theory of autoimmunity. But just to show the effect of repeated vaccinations triggering autoimmune reactions, in this case, a lupus-type reaction in mice. So there could be your connection with vaccinations.
And that was in what journal? What did?
I don't have the name of the journal. The article is called Self-Organized Criticality Theory of Autoimmunity.
Okay, I'll search that. And also, I just got a instant message from Todd Lapine saying that if you do the CD57,
yeah,
you should try to do it with LabCorp because they do the most accurate count. They actually give an absolute CD57. So
that's great. Thank you.
Might calculate it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, thank you very much.
No problem. All right.
For some reason, when I hit the take next question, it's not working right. So.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, all the ones still hanging there are people who already asked the question. So.
Okay.
I started doing it when you hung up, so I think we may have jumbled it. So, anyway, but I wanted to thank Nick for being on. I want to thank everyone else for taking time out of your precious evening to be with us, and we're honored that you were here. And next week on Clinical Rounds, we will have Mark Mendelsohn, who's been on Clinical Rounds before. He's been a Glacier Fest speaker, and he's been a webinar guest for Designs for Health. He always has great things to say, and he'll be talking about natural supplements and interventions for diabetes and diabetes reversal protocol. So join us with Mark Mendelsohn next week, and hopefully we'll see you at one of our upcoming seminars, including CORE 3 in San Francisco in a couple of weeks in September 29th, Houston on October 27th. And Andy, just one more time, do you have those CORE 2 dates? I don't have those in front of me.
Yep, CORE 2 dates are September 22nd in Traverse City, Michigan, and also Chicago, Illinois on November 3rd.
Thank you, everyone, for being on, and we look forward to having you on another Clinical Rounds call, and thanks for sharing everything, Nick. And, Nick, did you want to mention your website for some of your continuing ed stuff?
Yeah, it's www.infectionconnection.net. So it's all one word, infectionconnection.net, and there's some good information on there about this topic.
Right, .net, not .com, right?
Right, yeah, .net.
Right. Excellent. Okay, thanks, everybody, and have a wonderful evening.
Good night, Nick. Good night, David.